attorney from Houston who will be taking a seat on this court on January 1, so don't steal her notes. And the court has four causes to enforce. Actually, the court has five consolidated into four causes for submission on the oral submission docket today. In the order in which they will be heard, they are as follows. National Industrial Sand Association versus the Honorable Jay Gibson, an original mandamus proceeding. State Farm Lloyds versus Ion and Liana Nicolau from Nueces County. Austin David Barber and others versus the Colorado Independent School District from Mitchell County. And Owens, Illinois, Inc., Fiber Board Corporation, King Corporation, and Pittsburgh Corning Corporation versus the estate of Otis Burke, Mabel Burke, and Ronald Burke, and others from Harris County, consolidated with Owens, Illinois, Inc., Fiber Board Corporation, King Corporation, and Pittsburgh Corning Corporation versus Irma May Friley, individually and as representative of the estate of Joseph Friley, and others also from Harris County. In each of these four matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. The petitioner or relator may preserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will conclude the arguments before the lunch break. The court is recording these arguments for its convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. We are now ready to hear argument from Relator in National Industrial Sand versus Gibson.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Frost will present argument for Relator. Relator is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court, opposing counsel. My name is Bob Frost, and I'm pleased to be here on behalf of the National Industrial Sand Association, which I'll refer to this morning as NISA, a little handier. NISA is a nonprofit trade association who focuses its activity primarily on lobbying and related activities on behalf of its members in the silica sand industry. They're not a manufacturer of silica sand or any product for that matter. They don't sell any product. They have 30 members across the country, only one of which resides in Texas. Plaintiffs filed suit.
What percentage of the sand industry is that at work?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
And are there other organizations like this?
There are.
Represent competing companies?
There are others, yes.
Within the sand industry?
Aggregate industry, I would say. I'm not clear about how many competing associations there might be.
Okay, it's a minor point.
Plaintiffs filed suit in Ector County, Texas, claiming that they contracted silicosis in the process of sandblasting activities while working for their employers. I would characterize the underlying case as basically a product liability case against the manufacturers of silica sand, against the distributors of silica sand, and against the manufacturers and distributors of the respiratory equipment that these people were utilizing at the time.
I'm a little confused about just what the underlying cases are. There were a lot of these cases, but only three of them involved NISA as a defendant. And one of those had a summary judgment?
That's true, Your Honor.
Are there two left that we could consider the underlying cases here, and one's in the 70th District and the other in the 211?
At this moment, it's a little confusing. There are two remaining of the three that were brought forward in this case. There are a total of five cases, actually, in Ector County, some of which have not been heard yet on the special appearance. There are a total of 21 cases now, all told. 16 of them have now been filed in Beaumont, Jefferson County.
Those are where NISA is a defendant.
Yes. So the issue is expanding, which is why I'm glad we're here. There is a very narrow and novel argument being made in these cases against NISA, and that is that we potentially, reportedly, conspired to resist an NIOSH proposed ban on silica sand.
And just one last procedural question.
Sure.
On the two in Ector County, have you moved for summary judgment and that's been denied? Or the specialist appearance first thing you filed and that hasn't been ruled on? I mean, that's been ruled on, but it's up here and other proceedings have stopped while it's up here. What's the...
As a matter of judicial economy, the court consolidated three cases solely for the purpose of the special appearance. We did hear the special appearance in those three cases only. special appearance has not been heard in any of the other cases pending. We heard a motion for summary judgment in the Garcia case.
Which was one of those three.
One of those three, and that summary judgment was granted on behalf of NISA. There is a deadline for filing of summary judgment motions in other cases, but unfortunately they're not scheduled to be heard until the spring at the earliest.
All right, thank you.
NISA is a Delaware corporation with its principal place of business in Silver Springs, Maryland. They've never been sued in Texas before, and they firmly believe that they do not have sufficient minimum contacts with this state to justify the exercise of personal jurisdiction over it. So we filed a special appearance, asserting no personal jurisdiction. These three cases were consolidated only for the purpose of arguing and hearing the special appearance matter, and the trial court, we believe, improperly denied that special appearance. I'm here seeking mandamus relief, seeking to overturn this erroneous ruling of the trial court in a special appearance matter. I'm painfully aware of the great shadow that's being cast on parts of this argument in any event by virtue of the Canadian Helicopters versus Whittig case, which was decided by this court very recently. Nevertheless, we bring forward 2 points today, the first of which I probably am not going to argue vigorously at this moment because we don't have time for it, and I'm not sure that I've been invited here to urge the court to revisit the Canadian Helicopters case. But nevertheless, the first point is mandamus should be available to review a trial court's overruling of a special appearance because A, due process considerations compel an early and a final isolation and resolution of this personal jurisdiction issue, this constitutional issue, and B, the postponing of the resolution of such a threshold issue until years later is not an adequate remedy. The second point we raise here today is that even if this court is inclined to leave Canadian Helicopters versus Whittig undisturbed, we believe that NISA is entitled to mandamus relief here because the trial court's action in overruling NISA's special appearance was a clear abuse of discretion. And a matter of fact, it was tantamount to such disregard for the guiding principles of law that harm is irreparable here. I don't believe that the plaintiff today is going to make any serious effort to assert that NISA has subjected itself to general jurisdiction of the state of Texas. I may be surprised, but I don't believe that will be the contention. The traditional elements of such general jurisdiction are totally absent in this case. NISA is not a state resident. It has no registered agent in Texas. It has never maintained a place of business here. It has no employees or agents here. It has no office or mailing address or telephone number here. It doesn't own any assets in Texas. It doesn't pay any taxes and never has in Texas. It has no bank accounts in Texas. It doesn't lease any property in Texas. It's never been a party to a lawsuit in Texas in all of its 58 years of existence. It's not had any contact whatsoever with any of the plaintiffs or the plaintiff's employers.
Assuming you're right, what's different about this case from Canadian Helicopters?
Canadian Helicopters, as I understand what the court found there or believed, was that there was sufficient general jurisdiction there over that company. There were three contracts with Texas companies. There was an agreement to deliver at least two helicopters to Texas.
The court never said that. The court never said there were sufficient contracts with general jurisdiction.
No.
The court said it wasn't going to look at that.
Although the distinguishing features that I derive from looking at it is seeing items like that. There's a lawyer on the board of directors who's from Texas and several other Texas connections.
Maybe I ought to rephrase my question. If there was an adequate remedy by appeal in Canadian Helicopters, why is there no adequate remedy by appeal in this case?
Well, I believe that there is no adequate remedy by appeal in any of these cases.
Because the trial court has made a constitutional error?
That.
Doesn't the trial court make, or at least don't trial courts routinely rule on legal and even constitutional questions that we do not attempt to remedy by mandamus? And why is this one different?
My concern here is that I don't see the adequate remedy on appeal. We all know that it takes a couple of years to get a case to the point it goes to trial. It probably takes 2 or 3 years to get a case to the point that we get here and finally have a court review whether or not there is actually jurisdiction in a particular matter. That belated resolution, in effect, causes a loss of the very fundamental constitutional right not to be sued in a jurisdiction where there's no jurisdiction at all.
The U.S. Supreme Court has indicated they're not worried about it from a federal constitutional ground. Most states have indicated they're not worried about it. And Texas followed what appeared, at least to the author of that opinion, to be the majority rule. I mean, is there anything different about this case? Either the number of related cases or the fact that they presented there that makes this different? Or do we just have to decide whether or not we're going to reduce stare decisis to 6 months?
Well, if I understand, or at least I hope I'm interpreting what the court has said in Canadian Helicopters, or maybe not said but implied, is that we are not going to countenance having a trial court or intermediate court abuse the defendant's constitutional rights. And, for example, if there were no contact whatsoever with Texas, I don't believe that this court would stand by and say, we're going to permit this defendant to be subjected to the jurisdiction of this court over a protracted period of 4 or 5 years without a remedy. So I guess the question is, where is the line? There is some contact evidence by the record in this case, but so slender as to not merit serious consideration from the standpoint of jurisdiction. This court finds and permits remedies in all sorts of situations, in arbitration cases, which frankly I find hard to distinguish from this case, from issues of discovery where someone's pleadings are stricken, and the court presumably says, well, we're not going to subject that defendant to going through an entire trial if there was an error made at the threshold by the trial judge, which is going to simply undo it and make that whole case a nullity, and go back later and try it over again. I don't see any difference here. The court also recognizes mandamus in situations where there's a disqualification of witnesses or disqualification or potential disqualification of lawyers, all of which goes back to make the whole case a nullity and a waste of time. And this belated, then, resolution of it is not an adequate remedy. And I find it hard to believe that the court could then not say in the same breath that something as elementary as the lack of jurisdiction over an entity, something so basic to our sense of justice, could go unrepaired by the court.
Are you saying we've been inconsistent?
Yes. Yes.
And
the problem I think that happens there, what I think happens there is the bar is left without any guiding principle as to when is mandamus available and when isn't available. And I think it can be simply handled by just simply being very firm in a resolution of each case and requiring that there be a clear abuse of discretion before you are going to consider mandamus. I think that protects you from a frivolous appeal or a frivolous application for writ of mandamus, and yet it strikes a balance where it gives then a defendant such as Nisa, who's been abused here, an opportunity to right a wrong. This case, here we are with another trial judge, not the same trial judge who heard the special appearance. We have another trial judge in this case who has looked at the evidence after all the discovery is over with and has granted a summary judgment, has said, there aren't any fact issues in this case. Now, how is it that we could be subject to the jurisdiction of this court on the theory of a conspiracy, and there isn't even a fact issue superimposed upon the fact that there is inadequate evidence of a minimum contact with this state to justify hailing this defendant into Texas and subjecting it to a lawsuit? And not just one lawsuit or two lawsuits. I believe that this reluctance to review an abuse of discretion such as this will encourage lawsuits, will encourage forum shopping and has done that in this case. We have expanded from one case to two cases to three to five to six. We're now involved in 21 cases in Beaumont and Odessa. And we have no remedy. Presumably, if Canadian Helicopters stand for 4 or 5 years. And then the remedy we have is the court says, well, you know what, Nisa, you were right. 5 years ago, when you raised that special appearance, you were right.
The court has said we're not going to get into every discovery matter.
I understand.
It's got to be one that so wholly negates the use of a trial, and we'll get into it. And the court said we're not going to do every special appearance. Just simply, it's a big state. There's a lot of special appearances. We're not going to look at every one. And we're only going to get into those that are so clear on their face that it's not a point that needs to percolate through the system. Now, let's just assume the court stays with that ruling and does not overrule it. Do you have any points to make why your case is different than any of the other thousands of special appearances that are filed each year? Or is this one that, I mean, is there something that we could say this is not a case that should percolate through the system, or is it one that should?
Well, I think I would point to the fact that there just simply is, it is such an abuse of the guiding principles of personal jurisdiction that it is tantamount to no evidence of contacts worthy of consideration. And so I think we are precariously close in this case to a situation where there are no contacts, and yet a trial judge has arbitrarily decided that they are going to require this entity to remain in Texas, even though there is not even a viable cause of action against them under Texas law. I think that makes this an extraordinary case.
Mr. Frost, how is that different from a defendant who sued, who is entitled to a summary judgment, but for some reason a district judge declines to grant a summary judgment, they're forced to go through a trial and appeal, even though ultimately it's decided they were entitled to win at the first get-go?
I think the distinction has to be that we're dealing with constitutional issues here. As Justice Phillips said, you can't mediate, you can't referee every argument in the trial court and every dispute in the trial court, but you can grade the papers of a trial judge when we're dealing with constitutional issues of the magnitude we're dealing with here, the very basic of jurisdiction over a person or an entity. And that's the distinction that I see here.
Any other questions? Thank you. Court is ready to hear argument. Yes, please report.
Ms. Diane White, present argument. Respond.
May it please the court. Mr. Shaw, may I begin by saying that this is an original mandamus proceeding. Mandamus, as the court well knows, is an extraordinary remedy that exists only to protect substantive rights. Now, the court has focused this morning in questions to Mr. Frost about how is this case different from every other special appearance in the state of Texas. I would suggest to the court that it is no different.
So no matter how egregious the trial court's constitutional error in accepting jurisdiction over a case, you've got to go through the appellate pipeline.
Your Honor, I think that's the best exercise of the writ of mandamus.
No matter how egregious.
Yes, sir, I believe that.
And so what we said the Canadian Helicopters about, we did reserve the opportunity, was unwise. We should say it's up to the trial judge forever.
Your Honor, as a matter of policy, I believe that. And let me tell you why I believe that. It is because the constitutional right, as articulated by the United States Supreme Court in the Burger King case and in the International Shoe case, is not a constitutional right not to be sued. It is not a constitutional right not to have to defend oneself. Instead, it is a constitutional right not to be bound by judgments entered by a court without jurisdiction.
Why should we ever have a discovery mandamus?
Well, fortunately, I have fortunately not been involved in discovery mandamus. But let me say from my study of Walker versus Packer, I think the rules that are articulated in Walker versus Packer about discovery can be applied to a special appearance also. I don't think there's any real inconsistency with that standard, and let me explain why. Walker versus Packer suggested that you had to have three issues. You had to establish those three points. The person moving for mandamus had to establish those. And the first one was that they had to establish that the trial court failed to follow the appropriate legal standard. In Walker versus Packer, to paraphrase, the legal standard there, the court implied or applied erroneously, was whether or not the information sought was relevant rather than whether or not it was discoverable. And that was clearly wrong. And then whether or not that was an abuse of discretion. And the court's opinion, written by Justice Phillips, said yes, clearly it was. But thirdly, the court found, and I agree, that there was no, they could not establish that there was not an adequate remedy on appeal in Walker versus Packer. In this case, we can show the court quite easily that the trial court followed the appropriate legal standard. So the first test is not even met. We can show that by following the appropriate legal standard and by having specific jurisdiction in this case, it's not a general jurisdiction case. We can show that there was no abuse of discretion. And thirdly, of course, there's an adequate remedy on appeal. There is absolutely no difference from the court's observations 6 months ago in Canadian Helicopters about the adequacy of that remedy for that case than there is here.
Does it make any difference that there's 20 other cases like this pending across the country? Should that make a difference to us? Is our job to expedite the administration of justice?
I don't think so.
Would it make any difference if there were 2,000?
Pardon?
If there were, there are still probably thousands of asbestos cases and hundreds of silica cases, maybe thousands.
Your Honor, it's fortunate, at least, for the victims of silicosis that there are nowhere as many victims of that disease as there are of asbestos.
If NISA was brought into every silicosis case, would that make a difference? Is that something we should just answer this question or should we let every case percolate up?
Your Honor,
eventually,
one would expect that there would be an adjudication by a court of appeals
about
whether or not there was jurisdiction.
In the meantime, these victims might all have had a tainted trial because the wrong defendant was in there.
That risk operates for both sides, Your Honor.
That's not something we ought to consider, but it might be a good idea to get some finality in a case if there's a lot of related cases and get these people either their money or no money and get everybody.
Well, Your Honor, it didn't taint the result in the Garcia case. Mr. Garcia received about $700,000 in settlements. He proceeded to trial against one defendant. It did not taint or affect the result in the Garcia case. And that would certainly...
Well, that NISA was out of that case.
Because the court granted a summary judgment. It is only when a different trial court reaches a different resolution of that issue, which may occur, may not occur.
Are the factual allegations in Garcia similar to the factual allegations in the other two cases?
The pleadings have now been expanded in the other two cases. Lidwell.
What is the specific jurisdiction?
Let me explain that to the court. What you have is NISA's active participation in a tort that was committed in Texas.
How could they get summary judgment if that's true?
Because the court considered whether or not the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine operated to insulate NISA's activities. The court refused to follow the R.J. Reynolds, Rogers versus R.J. Reynolds case, a decision of the Beaumont Court of Appeals.
Did you appeal that decision?
Yes, sir. So there should be resolution of that question. If it turns out on that issue that we no longer have a cause of action to assert against NISA, then I could suggest to the court that that issue be resolved. But what I'm telling the court is that they were actively involved in labeling activity, telling their members what an adequate warning was.
How many members did they have in Texas?
One, Texas Mining Company. One of the largest producers of industrial sand in Texas and in the United States.
I presume, being a trade association, they had printed publications that they sent to their members. They solicited dues from their members. It was a financial arrangement.
Yes. Exhibit F. Exhibit F constitutes all of the correspondence and contacts between NISA and Texas Mining Company. And the product sold by Texas Mining Company was used by these three claimants in Odessa, Texas. It's our contention that the inadequate warning that was placed on the bags of sand by Texas Mining Company was directly influenced by the conduct and specific activity of NISA, which was not fortuitous, was not random, and was not attenuated. What you have here before you today is a visual aid which I prepared. They're excerpts from Exhibit F. The first page shows a letter to all member companies, including Texas Mining Company, where NISA recommended a specific warning, quote, in view of product liability litigation.
Is there any authority that you rely on that a person who lives in another state is asked for their advice on a question and they mail a letter into Texas answering that advice? Is there any authority that says that subjects the person to the general jurisdiction of this state?
Justice Enoch, it's not just one letter. But let me try to answer the question. We know that in cases of libel and slander, a publication in a state, dissemination of the information in a state, gives that state jurisdiction over the person making the publication. You'll find that in the Hustler case and also in the Shirley Jones libel case.
So it would be 10 letters then would subject this person who is an out-of-state person to the general jurisdiction of this?
If the cause of action grows out of the contents of the letter. So that is the very essence of specific jurisdiction.
This wasn't a simple matter of correspondence, business relationship.
Yes, sir, ongoing.
There was money exchanged,
yes,
advice solicited. Information disseminated.
Meetings attended, roundtables on product liability, what we should tell users of our product. But what I'm telling the court is the very specific warning that this lawsuit grew out of, there's two of them, issued by Texas Mining. These documents clearly show that NISA had a hand in the promulgation of those specific warnings. They speak for themselves. The second page in the visual aid prepared shows that Texas Mining Company substantially adopted the warning issued or recommended by NISA. The next set of documents shows that NISA continues on in formulating a national labeling policy for sandblasting sand and industrial sand. It shows that they solicit warnings and distribute warnings. The page that's marked 362 is a warning that they sent to Texas Mining Company that recommended the use of an inadequate protective device which violated with OSHA standards for sandblasting, which would lead to under protection and overexposure and would certainly cause silicosis. The last page of the visual aid shows that Texas Mining Company took that warrant that was sent to it and implemented and used it on its product.
Where is that? It says here follow the OSHA safety standards.
Yes, sir. But they recommended a dust respirator to prevent overexposure. 29 CFR 1910-94 requires the use of an air-supplied type CE hood for sandblasting. And these men wore dust respirators while they were doing their work. All of these men are residents of the state of Texas. All of these men have silicosis. All of these men are dying. And all of these men are under 40 years old.
I could see if you just had one case. There was one silicosis case in the state of Texas, and Mesa was a defendant. You were trying to bring him, and you would say, let us try to bring them, let us make their record. Try to get past the summary judgment. Try to get a judgment to come up and show you why we have jurisdiction over this out-of-state company that should collect the judgment. But now that we're here, and there's at least 20 other cases around the state where there's a defendant, wouldn't all your clients be better off if the court takes a look at this question now?
Your Honor, if the court does reach the merits of the controversy, I think that specific jurisdiction has been established. I think that we do not have a bad result for my clients if you reach the merits. But what you do by doing that is saying that if it's a mass tort, if it involves more than one isolated incident like a helicopter crash, we'll let you have a mandate.
How do you reconcile our granting review by mandamus in arbitration cases like Angle versus Tip for death penalty sanction cases and our refusal in National Helicopter versus Bridge? How do you reconcile those cases?
I hope that I do not have to accept the role of the defender of some inconsistency of results in this court.
So they are inconsistent, you
acknowledge? Why, yes, they are. I think they are.
And there's no rationale you can offer for that inconsistency?
No, Your Honor, I cannot find one.
Is consistency preferable to inconsistency?
I think consistency on questions is preferable. Let me explain what I mean by that. Most practitioners in the state of Texas now know, as a result of Walker versus Packer, that you ought not to routinely apply for mandamus review from a discovery order that you think is inappropriate. That's the message of that case. It's been heard and noted, and it's made a difference. I think the message of Canadian Helicopters is that in special appearances, you ought not to apply for mandamus.
Isn't the issue whether you have a justiciable controversy that would appropriately assert jurisdiction over this defendant? It's not whether you will ultimately prevail.
No, Your Honor, it isn't.
It's whether you have a justiciable controversy.
That's right.
A lawsuit.
Yes, sir.
And whether they're a proper party to this lawsuit.
Yes, sir. That's the merits issue. And I believe that we can show that there is a nexus, a specific relationship with their activities with Texas Mining and the cause of action alleged. Do you realize how different this case is from Canadian Helicopters? There is no connection with any of Canadian Helicopters' activities in the state of Texas. There is a direct connection between NESA's activities with Texas Mining Company, their sale of products, and the use of those products with my clients. My clients, plural. And, Your Honor, NESA has to be named in every case in which they are a proper party because of the statute of limitations. We don't have the luxury of not naming them in all of the other lawsuits until this controversy is complete. The statute of limitations, the Texas Civil Practice Code, Remedies Code, requires us to bring in all of the proper parties within 2 years after discovery of the decision. I don't think that 20 cases is such a crushing caseload that the court should abandon Canadian Helicopters and substitute it with something else.
Is it fair to say, Counsel Lowe, that these 20 cases are just the tip of the iceberg and there's more to come?
Well, Your Honor, I've been doing silicosis work for 10 years now. I've probably handled more silicosis cases than any other trial lawyer in the state of Texas. There is no crush of cases like there is asbestos cases. There is no mushrooming docket of silicosis cases. And I'm happy about that.
The question was, are there more to come? And the answer is no.
I'm sure there will be a few people diagnosed every year that have silicosis.
So the answer is yes.
A few. But not all of those people who have silicosis will have used Texas Mining Company's product. Not all of them will have relied on the warning issued by Texas Mining Company. So just because there is a silicosis case, it does not mean that Texas Mining Company is involved or that NISA's conduct is involved.
Can you tell me more about this civil conspiracy that you're alleging between NISA and Texas Mining?
Yes, Your Honor. Our allegations...
Besides the handout you gave here,
right.
Besides your visuals, is there more?
Yes.
Or is this it?
There's more than that.
Tell me about it.
And it's dealt with to some extent in the brief. But what we're saying is that beginning in this 1970s, after NIOSH proposed that this country follow the same rule followed in Great Britain and the European Economic Community and not permit sand to be used for abrasive blasting in the United States, that industry allied together to protest that ban. Their activities...
So protest amounts to a civil conspiracy?
No, sir. Right. Their protest had two fronts, one that was perfectly legal and protected by the First Amendment, and one that was not protected and not perfectly legal.
What crossed the line? Tell me about the ones that crossed the line.
When there is collusion on a national labeling standard.
What evidence of collusion is there in this record?
This is it, Your Honor. There's a lot of other documents.
The correspondence between NISA.
Product liability roundtables where the other members of NISA and Texas Mining Company got together to promulgate a uniform warnings policy where the risks of silicosis were understated and the means and methods of protecting the users of the product were not mentioned, or else the wrong recommendations were given.
They were acting illegally or performing some illegal purpose?
Yes, their purpose was to continue the use of sand and to cause the overexposure and the underprotection of workers.
To intentionally harm workers?
To cause injury, yes.
To intentionally cause injury?
Yes, sir.
That's a conspiracy?
Yes, sir. Now, I forgot where I was. Someone had asked me a question that I didn't complete answering. And I think it had to do with the difference between this case and the Canadian helicopter case. You know, NISA did not have to render such advice. It did not have to tell members to put a warning on their bag. It certainly did not have to tell members what kind of a warning to place on them.
If NISA had said, "Now it's just trying to put us out of business," and some people talk about warnings, but we have nothing to say about warnings, that would have been better?
I think it should have advised its members that the duty to warn is different in every state, and that the issue of silicosis is a grave and serious one, and that any warning should tell people that silicosis is a harmful, fatal disease, and how you can protect yourself when you use the product. That's what they should have done.
So you're saying, Councilman, that nonprofit associations that, that act as clearinghouses for information for an association cannot be proactive. They just can't just pass information without advice.
And my red light is on, but I hope
they do,
I get a chance
to answer. As long as we want to.
If they do dare advise their members, they're subjecting themselves to the, because of the mailings, to the jurisdiction of whatever, of Texas.
My response is twofold. First, they have a duty to give the right advice, not to understate the dangers and not to give advice about using the wrong protective equipment. They have that same duty as anyone else. But second of all of these arguments relate to the merits of the controversy between NISA and the plaintiff.
Now we're asking you to look to tell us about the continuous and systematic contacts, which is the very basis of power jurisdiction. That's
as a specific jurisdiction case, if the contacts, even if they are not continuous and not systematic, if it's a specific jurisdiction case.
So you're saying that the elements of continuous and systematic contacts is not the standard in this case?
It's applicable to a general jurisdiction case.
And so continuous and systematic contacts between NISA and Texas Mining should be ignored?
No. It's the character of those contacts and whether there is a nexus between the contacts, as in the Slobom case, whether the contacts themselves give rise to the cause of action. if the activities of a defendant in a forum are isolated or disjointed, jurisdiction is proper if the cause of action arises from the particular activity. Schlobaum versus Shapiro, Supreme Court of Texas, February 1990.
You've answered the question.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Frost, if I understand Ms. Dwight's argument, she's saying NISA promulgated these labels. They sent the labels to their membership. Their membership put those labels on the silica. NISA is being sued for the content of those labels. Therefore, Texas courts have jurisdiction because those labels were used in Texas. Is that a correct application of specific jurisdiction under the special appearance law?
No, for a number of reasons, Your Honor. One, I believe that factually there is a misinterpretation of what NISA did here. The very handout that plaintiff's counsel provided to the court, it's bait stamp number 077, and it's dated June 23, 1977, which supposedly is the document which contains the warning that NISA supposedly promulgated. When you look at that document, you see that what NISA did there, this is simply an informational letter. It's simply a letter that a trade association would ordinarily write. It says, warnings recommended on a criteria document of crystalline silica by the National Institute of Occupational Safety, by a governmental organization. Here is the warning recommended by NIOSH members. Then what do they do at the end of that letter? They say, members may wish to consult their counsel as to whether this form is suitable or should be revised. All they were doing is doing what a trade association does, is providing informational materials to their members and saying, do with it as you wish, but here is a proposed NIOSH warning. And that NIOSH warning, not our warning, the NIOSH warning, was adapted apparently in some form by Texas Mining, although they embellished it, as you see from the next handout, because it's got additional language. Texas Mining added some additional language for whatever reason, presumably because they did consult their counsel, as we suggested they should, before deciding whether to use this or not. In trying to look at the quantity or the quality of contacts here, please keep in mind, NISA has been in business since 1936, 58 years. And the best they can do is come up with a small packet like this of informational materials that were provided to member companies, one of whom was in Texas, in 58 years. That is woefully inadequate. That is an abuse. We have no purpose being in Texas. There is no personal jurisdiction over our client. And on top of that, there's not even a cause of action. The Diaz case, and again, this goes, just scenic, to what you were talking about here. First of all, there's no fact to support what they're contending. But second of all, there's no cause of action associated with it. The Diaz versus Southwest Wheel case is instructive. It's very similar to this case, where there it was contended that some members of an organization, a manufacturing organization, conspired with the rim manufacturers in the industry to thwart the efforts of the National Highway Traffic Safety Association to ban multi-piece rims. The court, Corpus Christi Court of Appeals, writ denied in 1987, said, an essential element of a conspiracy is an unlawful overt act. The Sherman Act does not prohibit two or more persons from associating together in an attempt to persuade the legislature or the executive to take a particular action with respect to a law. In a representative democracy such as this, these branches of government act on behalf of the people, and to a very large extent, the whole concept of representation depends upon the ability of the people to make their wishes known to their representatives. The right of people to inform their representatives in government of their desires with respect to the passage or enforcement of laws cannot properly be made to depend upon their intent in doing so. It is neither unusual nor illegal for people to seek action on laws in the hope that they may bring about an advantage to themselves and a disadvantage to their competitors. We find the rationale of the Norr-Pennington Doctrine applicable to the case at bar and hold that the acts alleged by the appellants were not illegal, The very same acts were alleged here.
She's alleging a little more than that, though, isn't she? If I understood her correctly, she said you were acting in two areas, actually. One, which is perfectly legitimate, which you just described. The other, involving what she described as a conspiracy to subvert what would be legitimate standards as far as labeling is concerned.
And I think the key, again, is that on that very allegation, and with extended discovery permitted in the trial court reviewed all of the evidence of these allegations, and on a summary judgment, where actually the burden was against us, to presume all facts against us, the trial court said, there's no facts to support these allegations, and therefore, certainly no facts to suggest contacts with the state of Texas such to create personal jurisdiction.
Was the bank number 362 document this morning something NISA developed out of the roundtable meeting it had on morning? Or was this something it was passing along from a government body? I know I can dig that out.
No, and actually, plaintiff's counsel may be able to help. I believe that was something that just came from one of the other member companies. Is that true?
If I might, they solicited this warning to other member companies and passed down those warnings to other member companies. This is not a government-approved warning.
All right, thank you.
Again, what they were doing is assembling all of the material safety data sheets, the warnings, the literature, the packaging from all of their member companies, assembling them together, taking the names off of them, so that nobody knew where they came from, and just sending them out to their member companies saying, this is what other people are doing in the industry. You might be interested.
Here again, you're talking about, you mentioned yourself, the quality and quantity of contacts. How many people do you have to be doing business with in Texas to be a part of this program? You have a dues-paying member. I presume that the trade association solicits and accepts money from this Texas business and disseminates information as a benefit of membership to this Texas business, and perhaps as reciprocal information. Information from Texas may go to other members in other jurisdictions. The point is not whether you're going to prevail on the merits. The point is, do they have a lawsuit and appropriate jurisdiction over you in the controversy as alleged?
Well,
that's the bottom line, not whether you're going to win.
I agree, Your Honor. The only reason I even mentioned the law applicable to their contentions is that if the facts upon which they're contending jurisdiction rests don't support a cause of action, then the facts are irrelevant.
Is that case being appealed?
Pardon me?
Is that case being appealed? That's not a final judgment, is it?
There's no final judgment. There is a motion for new trial pending. There's been no notice of appeal as far as I know.
One lawsuit, one court. You got a summary judgment. It's up on motion for rehearing right now, and it's irrelevant to our considerations today.
Well, the only reason I suggested it might be relevant is that if the contacts they're claiming don't support a cause of action, then the contacts are really immaterial to the court's determination as to whether or not they justify jurisdiction here. And I didn't mean to get off on that tangent.
Any other questions? Thanks. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience, Mr. Bryant.